So we talk about early warning of landslides using acoustic emission. And acoustic emission monitoring is basically listening to the slope, so listening to the soil as it starts to move. And so people have for many years known that when rock falls occur, you can hear the rock starting to move, etc. But we were particularly interested in soils, of whether you could pick up grains of soil starting to move against each other at depth in the slope as a failure started. And if you can detect these early enough, then you can provide a warning to go and investigate the slope by experts or to evacuate people or whatever the appropriate warning is for the type of slope and the mechanism of failure.
Learn more about the use of acoustics in slope monitoring after this advert.
Central Piling are proud to sponsor the Breaking Ground podcast. It aligns with our goals of providing technical expertise, continuous improvement and community engagement. These are things we've been striving for since our inception over 40 years ago. Some of the engineering achievements during that time include the design and construction of the foundations for West London's tallest residential building, complex 3D finite element analysis to facilitate the creation of a triple-storey basement, and damage impact assessments for underground assets on a rotary-cased piling contract. Our plant includes a wide range of bored piling machine sizes. These are continually being updated to ensure emission regulation compliance and efficiency. We're also able to offer driven precast and steel piling on selected contracts. To learn more about what we do and discover details of how we might be able to help you on your next foundation or retaining wall scheme, visit centralpiling.com.
Today on the Breaking Ground podcast, we return to my alma mater, Loughborough University, and I'm going to be talking to Neil Dixon, a professor. In fact, Neil, you're recently retired, is that right?
Yes, I've started my retirement, so I'm finishing off a few projects, which we're going to talk about today. But in terms of my sort of day-to-day academic career, I've now entered retirement, yeah.
Oh, good for you. How's the golf handicap coming along?
Haven't got to play yet, but it's on my list of things to do.
Well, you deserve the break, but it's great to hear that you're still going to be involved and staying in touch with the students and some of these projects. You're here today to talk about slope stability and acoustics, and I know there's some fantastic work that you've been doing there with the department and in the laboratory. I know you've listened to the episode that we did on slope stability and climate change with Dave Petley, and I can recommend that the listeners listen back to that if they haven't done so already to check out some of the issues that came out of it. Clearly, slope stability is causing a huge loss of life around the world, in large part led by climate change. There's a big economic cost from that. And your work will help inform decisions from companies and countries around the world so we can help manage that change. Traditionally, I suppose, we've looked at slopes and movements in slopes in a rather different way to how you're proposing we look at it now. I'm thinking things like piezometers, which, okay, don't necessarily look at the movement on the slopes, but they do look at water pressures, which could be a prelude to movement, and things like extensometers, tilt meters and inclinometers, which perhaps might be described as a more reactive in terms of the movement's already happened. So it may be a little bit too late to address the movement and the slope failure. How would you contrast those sort of methods with the sort of work that you're doing around acoustics? Why do we need different sorts of technology? What are the limitations of those particular methods compared to the use of acoustics within slope stability?
Yeah, it's a good question. So there's nothing wrong with the traditional techniques, particularly thinking of measuring the ground deformations. The issue is often around cost and also interpretation of the data. So we have technologies based on tilt meters, but particularly thinking about instruments which are installed below the ground, which are the most reliable for picking up development of shear surfaces. So they're the sort of slopes that we're interested in, those where there's a slide surface. And existing instrumentation in place inclinometers can do a really good job of indicating the onset of failure, of picking up the pre-failure deformations. And you can set trigger values and provide warnings. And if you understand the mechanism of failure, you could provide a warning to communities or infrastructure owners, and you could either do remedial actions or evacuate the site if it's people that are at risk. The problem is that they cost too much. So the people who are killed, the areas of the world where people are killed by landslide most are in Southeast Asia, Central South America, Africa, where the technologies could be used, but they're not used because the cost is too high. And of course, as countries become more economically able to pay for them, then some of those countries are starting to use these instruments. So my motivation was to try and develop a technique which was cheaper, to be quite honest. And it was very much around the early warning. So we talk about early warning of landslides using acoustic emission. And acoustic emission monitoring is basically listening to the slope. So listening to the soil as it starts to move. And so people have for many years known that when rock falls occur, you can hear the rock starting to move, etc. But we were particularly interested in soils, of whether you could pick up grains of soil starting to move against each other at depth in the slope as a failure started. And if you can detect these early enough, then you can provide a warning to go and investigate the slope by experts or to evacuate people or whatever the appropriate warning is for the type of slope and the mechanism of failure. So that was the motivation. And it went back to my PhD in the early 1980s, where we were monitoring some coastal landslides in the Thames estuary. And one day I got a phone call from one of the residents saying, "We heard some rumbling in the night. Could the slope be about to fail?" And the answer was no, it was London Clay, good old London Clay, which was failing. And it wasn't okay. That. It got me thinking about it. And I managed to find some papers of some work done in America and Japan, where they'd started to do some laboratory work and pick up grains of soil moving against each other. And so when I became an academic in the late 80s, this was the research project that I thought, well, I'll have a go at this. I'll get some equipment and I'll have a go at trying to do some measurements. And so 30 odd years later, we are where we are now, which we'll get to in a minute when we're discussing this, I guess. And proving that we can listen and pick up the early movements of slopes and provide an early warning.
Okay, because I didn't think you were going to go down that route. I thought it wouldn't be that the soil is making a noise, which is essentially what you're saying. I thought you were going to say, well, we send a signal and it's similar to geophysics techniques, and it's all about the time it takes to come back, the reverberations. So it's a completely different sort of concepts and technology.
Yeah, it's very different, which is one of the challenges of getting it established, is it's very different for geotechnical engineers to think about. However, in other applications, it is very well established. So if you're trying to detect the initiation and propagation of cracks in steel members of wings of aircraft or nuclear reactor cores, you use acoustic emission monitoring. But you're absolutely right. It's a passive system. You listen to the noise generated by deforming material. And to prove to yourself that this isn't bonkers, think of a piece of wood and you bending it and hearing the wood cracking and creaking.
Yeah.
That's what you're doing. There are two challenges here, though. One is that the amount of energy released by soil grains moving against each other is incredibly small. And also, as those, and basically you can think of noise as stress waves, and it's generated by contact between particles, and then it propagates through the soil to your sensor. But as it propagates from one soil grain to the next, it loses energy, so it attenuates very rapidly. So the challenges we had to overcome are based on detecting very locally to where the soil is deforming the acoustic emission, and getting those signals to the sensor. So they were the big challenges we had to overcome. And why do we call it acoustic emission and not just noise? Well, we call it acoustic emission because it's actually very high frequency noise. It's actually noise which is super audible, which means it's above what you can hear with the human ear. So while if I had some sand in my hand and I was crunching it, we could hear it on the microphone of this podcast. That is very low frequency noise, and that attenuates really, really rapidly. So we use high frequency noise, and that's really important because what we want in the end is to monitor slopes in the middle of nowhere with maybe some cows on the field or a road at the bottom or a train going past the rock bottom. And we want to monitor it continuously, and we don't want to pick up spurious noise. And by using high frequency noise, we can filter out construction noise and traffic noise. And maybe later on we'll get into some of the trials that we did where we had trains going past our sites and we didn't pick those trains up. So it's really important in a monitoring technique that you don't have false alarms, because, you know, it's the cry wolf. You know, people, you give the warns and in the end people ignore your instrument and the warnings because they've heard it so many times. So using high frequency is a really important part of the approach.
Yeah, because in a rock fall, you know, I can visualize, right, there's a rock fall, there's a big load of noise associated with that rock fall, but it's sort of, it's there 1 minute and then it's stopped. The movement ceased. What you're saying is in softer soils, there is a slow movement and a constant movement, which is creating a noise, but it's that's a high frequency noise.
Yeah, well, it's creating low frequency as well. It's just that we're not monitoring it. Our sensors are tuned to monitor the high frequency noise, because that then we can filter out all of the sources of noise and not give false alarms. And so we were always interested, obviously, being in the UK, with clay soils and monitoring clay soils, which develop shear surfaces. The problem there is that that even compared to sands, the amount of energy release is even lower and the attenuation is even higher. And so if you've got a shear surface, say 6 meters deep in a clay slope, how do you get the signal out of sort of initial deformations on that shear surface? And so you have to put something into the ground. So if you were going to use an inclinometer, you'd drill a borehole, you'd put an inclinometer casing in, and you'd either read it at periods of time and build up a profile of over time of how the slope's moving and where the shear surface is, or you would put an in-place inclinometer, which it can read continuously, but are quite expensive. So we also have to drill a hole through the slope. But rather than put an expensive sensor in the ground, what we put in the ground is a steel tube, and we surround it, the sort of the annulus between the steel tube and the borehole wall, we fill with noisy granular soil, so gravel or sand. And then we stick our sensor, which is the more expensive bit, we stick that on the top of the steel tube. So the idea is that as the slope starts to move, it generates some noise around the shear surface, but it also deforms the granular soil around the steel tube. So that's noisier than clay. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is that acoustic emissions, these high frequency stress waves, can propagate up steel tubes with hardly any losses. And so the signal gets generated at depth, and we've monitored landslides, shear surfaces 15, 20 metres deep, and these noise signals propagate up to the steel tube, and we have a sensor at the top of the steel tube, and that detects these stress waves. And it's the measurement of those stress waves which we quantify to produce a measure of displacement rate. So our acoustic emission sensors, we would call them displacement rate sensors. Hence, if you can pick up the acceleration of movement, that tells you that the stability of the slope is decreasing. And that's what you use as your warning.
Let's say we had a slope and it was 30 metres high and 30 degrees slope angle. Where would you place your equipment? How deep would it need to go to get some useful data?
Yeah, well, the way to think of this is that you would design the waveguide, which is what I've described in the steel tube and the backfill, you would design that in exactly the same way as you design an inclinometer. You have to have knowledge about the potential depth of a developing shear surface, and you must penetrate that developing shear surface, because it's the movements at that shear surface which is going to generate the acoustic emission. And so if you're picking up a first-time slide, you have to have enough knowledge to know where you should put your instrument. So whether you put it at mid-slope, whether you put it on the toe, whether you put two or three in. So for to try and pick up first-time failures, you need exactly the same skills as you do to put an inclinometer in. For reactivated failures, you just need to know where the shear surface is. You know, a failure that's already residual, and if you're worried that it might be reactivated, and then that's a bit simpler. You know, you can make sure you penetrate the shear surface. And we've got a number of sites we've monitored around the world where we've picked up reactivated movements and we've quantified the displacement rate from our acoustic emission monitoring.
So we're looking at doing a fairly basic slip circle analysis, and it's at the bottom of the slip circle is where you would need to penetrate.
Yeah, right? You need to penetrate the shear surface somewhere along its length. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And in terms of the acoustic equipment, is there any similarities with the work that seismologists do?
Not really, because it's a passive sensor. It's what's called a piezoelectric sensor, transducer. So at the top of the steel tube, we clamp a sensor onto the top of the steel tube. And the stress waves, so physical stress waves vibrating in the steel tube, are converted into a voltage using a piezoelectric transducer. So a piezoelectric material is one where, when it's deformed, it generates a voltage. And so these are very common sensors. And what you get is a voltage trace over time. But we're monitoring at 20 kilohertz. So we've got a very fast stress wave being recorded. And what we do is we analyze that stress wave to work out how much energy is being released by the acoustic emission. And we've calibrated the amount of energy that we measure with our sensors, and we've equated it to displacement rates. So we've done lots of laboratory work, as you can imagine, but over the last 10 years, we've installed our systems on a number of sites in the UK and around the world. And on all those sites, we've also had traditional inclinometer data. And so what we've been able to do is to pick up what the inclinometer has measured in terms of displacement rates and what our acoustics has detected. And that has allowed us to prove that the acoustic measurements are equivalent to the displacement rates. So our AE rates are equivalent to displacement rates. And we've done that through lots of trials, field trials.
But Neil, I've got to say, I'm hugely impressed by your ability to understand a technology that isn't traditional geotechnics. Like you and I, probably going back 15 years or maybe 20 years, worked on some research on displacement auger trials, which is more traditional geotechnics. But clearly, you've got many facets to your knowledge. So well done.
I mean, we're very much users of the technology. So other people have used AE, as I've said, in lots of different industries. I mean, it's used to monitor cable stays in bridges and all sorts of things. And in geotechnics, people have done some measurements, as I said, in Japan and in America. But we had two major breakthroughs that we had to, I guess, solve in order to make a system which works on site. One was to be able to quantify the AE. So why is Loughborough's research, why did it end up with sensors which are now commercially available, which they are? You can go out and buy acoustic sensors to monitor slopes because of our work. The big breakthrough was quantifying it. So it was relating the AE rate to the displacement rate, and that's all our lab work and trials. But the other thing was a bit of luck, really, which is because we're monitoring at really high frequencies, all our original work was done on a big computer that you couldn't take to the field. And we did some trials in the field where we took the most expensive laptop we could afford on our project, and we took it to the field, and we would monitor for a few minutes, and it would fill it up, and then we'd take it back to the lab, and we'd spend weeks looking at it. And the real big change was in the late 2000s, electronics developed to a stage where you could develop a battery-operated sensor that you could leave on a site and monitor continuously, and you could have a communication with it and download the data. And that, for the first time, allowed us to get data from a field continuously and to prove that it worked. And that was nothing to do with us. That was just luck that electronics developed to a stage. And we work with the British Geological Survey, who have lots of experience of developing sensors for use on site. So you said, you know, is this similar to resistivity type geophysics techniques? It isn't, but actually the people from the BGS who have that experience of making those sorts of instruments were involved as part of this to help develop our sensors. And once we had this group of battery-operated sensors, that allowed us to go off and around the world and do trials. So, you know, sometimes you have to wait for other industries to catch up to allow you to do something.
Yeah, definitely. And you mentioned there about the slope project, the work that you're doing in the lab and so on. That came out of the work that we were doing with a group called Achilles on clay slopes. Remind us who Achilles are and the work that they've done.
Yeah, it's actually been in parallel with Achilles, and and they're in parallel because my interest in instrumentation and landslides. So Achilles is a project funded by the Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council, so the UK government. And it's what's called a programme grant, which has a bit more flexibility. And it's got a number of partners. So it's the academic partners are Newcastle University, Durham, Leeds, Loughborough, Southampton, Bath, with the British Geological Survey, but also with owners of clay slope infrastructure. So Network Rail, London Underground, Environment Agency, National Highways. and also a number of consultants who work with those to help monitor and analyse and maintain slopes, people like Mott MacDonald and Jacobs. So it's a big four and a half year project, and it's looking at the effect of weather and the potential for climate change to increase the rate of deterioration of clay slopes, so basically cuttings and embankments. And I know you had quite a discussion with Dave Petley about these.
Yeah.
And he talked about deterioration of slopes. And some deterioration mechanisms are really, and the impacts of climate change are really quite straightforward. So, you know, he talked about weathered profiles on weak rock slopes. And so it's clear that over many years, the surface weathers and you get a looser, weaker material. And it's possible under a very extreme weather event, extreme rainfall, for that to be involved in a failure, a flow slide or an earth flow. And that's the type of failure that occurred at Stonehaven, where people were killed. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So in some parts of the UK, in certain geologies, the link between climate and climate change, more extremes and failures, is very clear. But there's a more subtle relationship between weather and climate change and failure of clay slopes. So I know you're interested in your journey to work on your train and whether it's affected by landslides in the clay slopes in the southeast. And the question I would have for you is, when we get a really wet winter, we get failures of clay slopes on the rail network. But why does it fail in this wet winter? Why didn't it fail 3 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when the winter was just as wet? Why is the slope different now than it was then?
Well, it's an accumulation, isn't it? Really, perhaps there's been an increase in the change of weather due to human factors, and what we're doing to the climate in terms of warming up the climate and having increased amounts of rainfall. So that has increased the number of slope failures, perhaps, but they're always going to happen. I mean, you look at coastal erosion, you know, there's always been coastal erosion and there always will be. It's just the pace of change that I think humans are struggling to live with. And that's why we need greater inspection of what's happening to our slopes, so humans can react to those ever-changing conditions.
Yeah, I think that's perfectly true. But there's also something behind that, which is it's possible to show that slopes can get hydrostatic pore water pressures in them, clay slopes, and have been able to for a number of years. So the pore pressure, although we're getting more rain, you could actually make the argument that how wet is wet. You know, you can't get wetter than wet. You can't get wetter than hydrostatic. So actually, the reason why slopes are falling down is because of deterioration of the shear strength of the material. So just like thinking of weathered material on a weak slope, what our work and other people's work has shown is that the clay itself, the clay slope and the clay itself, deteriorates as you put it through cycles of wetting and drying. So if you dry a slope out, you get high suctions, high suctions, which give you really high effective stresses and cracking and things. And then you wet it up and you get positive pore pressures. And this puts the soil through a cycle of positive and negative pore pressures and therefore a big range of effective stresses. And what's been shown is that you get a progressive failure mechanism in certain slopes of certain geometries and certain materials, particularly high plasticity overconsolidated clays. And so we were talking about monitoring and picking up pre-failure movements. There are people who have in centrifuge tests and some field data which shows that a shear surface starts to form over many, many cycles of this wetting and drying. And eventually, we call it ratcheting failure, where the slope moves slightly down slope and you get a softened zone at the toe. And for certain conditions, the slope can eventually fail. And so there is a long-term mechanism here that we need to understand. And that's what Achilles is looking at. And the reason why we talk a lot about network rail sites is they've got the oldest assets. So they've got slopes which were constructed 150, 180 years ago. So they've been through 180 years of wetting and drying. And some of the slopes will never fail. Some of the slopes have already failed and some might fail. And so what we're doing in Achilles is we are developing numerical models which actually model the slope every day of its life for 150 years. So the input to the models are daily weather. And so we start off with a slope, and we might be cutting an embankment. And so we have conditions of unloading the cutting, which I know Dave Petley talked about, which causes some reduction in pore pressures, which over many decades can increase. And you have embankments, which you have stresses in the fill due to construction. And we model all that. And then we model those slopes as they sit there with daily weather on them for another 100 years or whatever, and to see whether they fall down or not. And the importance of developing these models is that if we can validate these numerical models, we can then put climate change data into the models and see what will happen with wetter winter, drier summers, and whether that accelerates the rate of deterioration. And so Achilles is doing a number of things. It's trying to validate those numerical models. So the Achilles members have sites which they've been monitoring for a long time, where they've measured the weather at the site and they've measured how the pore pressures have changed in the slope in response to the weather. And we use that to calibrate our models. So Southampton University have got a site at Newbury, which is a road cutting, and they've been monitoring that since 2003, so 20 years of data. And Bionics is an embankment, a research embankment up in Newcastle. They've been monitoring that for 15 years. And Achilles has just instrumented a new site on an embankment, an environment-aided embankment. And you need these really long periods of time to validate the models. You need long periods of data because every year is slightly different. You know, we have dry summers and wet summers. And what we need in our data is, well, what happens if there's a dry summer followed by a dry winter? What happens if there's a wet summer followed by a wet winter? And the longer the data sets from our sites, the more of these combinations we're picking up. And so we've validated these numerical models, and now we're using climate forecasts or projections to drive the models into the future to see whether they're deteriorating more quickly. And the idea of doing it is to inform an assessment approach for the people who own these earthworks, like Network Rail, to try and understand which of their slopes might be closest to failure, so they can concentrate monitoring on those slopes, they can concentrate remediation techniques. And we're also looking at the cost of collecting data and the cost of remediating slopes, and when is the best time to intervene. You know, do you wait till it's fallen down, or do you intervene 20 years before it might fall down, etc. So Achilles is a big project with lots of different things going on.
Lots of stakeholders as well. Yeah. And you mentioned high-res agency, Network Rail. You know, clearly they've got public funds available to investigate these things. Also, there's a lot of people that are going to be aware of slope failures. There was a serious slope failure, I think it was in Scotland, that a couple of years ago, where unfortunately people were killed.
That's Stonehenge failure.
Yeah. So that's Stonehenge. And that, I think, really does bring it into the public consciousness and ensures that proper investigations are carried out. Interesting, you mentioned Newbury. Paul Fleming, your colleague, and I actually did a visit to the Newbury bypass when it was being built, so that's brought back some happy memories. But for those people that recall the project, there were many challenges during the building of that, and it sounds like there's one or two challenges still left in the scheme. you mentioned the group Achilles, but there's with your slope simulator project, there's also a group called the Wolfson Foundation that I picked up on, who they're a not-for-profit. Are they a charity?
They're a charity. That goes smoothly into why we're building a test facility. So I explained how we're validating our numerical models using the sites at Newbury and Bionics and the new embankment site. The problem is that they had not given us data on the progressive failure of the slopes, because the slope at Newbury and the slopes on the test embankment are not close to failure. And so to complete the circle of validating our numerical models, we need the weather input, how the pore pressures cycle, and then how they then drive straining of the soil and progressive movements. And we can't get that from these field sites. They weren't selected thinking the slopes would fail. We didn't think they were going to fail. It was from another part. We have centrifuge model data where slopes were brought to failure, work that was done at Cambridge in the 2000s by Andy Take. And so we validated our new models with that. And so we need a way of getting information about deformations in slopes to close the circle on our validation. And we also need ways of testing remediation technologies, how we might stabilize slopes. And although there are very traditional techniques of stabilizing slopes, like soil nails and drainage, once they're installed, it's not clear whether you've over-designed that or not. You know the slope is stable. You know if you haven't designed it properly, it falls down or it continues to move. But it's difficult to work out how much additional capacity you might have put in and whether the designs are too conservative. And so we had this idea that in the latter part of Achilles, so in the last year of Achilles and then following on from that, we would produce a large-scale testing facility at Loughborough for looking at climate impacts or weather impacts on clay slopes. There are many slope simulators around the world where people have built big slope simulators, but they're usually where they have quite high permeability soils and they rain on them and generate debris flows, fast-moving landslides, etc. This is specifically going to be looking at the performance of clay slopes and being able to dry out the slope and then wet it up using sprinklers and then take the slope to failure at the end. I'll explain a bit more about that in a minute. It's a big facility. It's going in its own building, 12 metres by sort of 12 metres. The test facility, this slope, is going to be 5 metres by 3 metres by a metre and a half deep, the soil. So we're going to compact soil in there. So it's going to be relevant for embankments. And we were able to compact the material in there and then lift the table to a slope angle that is typical of a slope we want to look at, you know, 1 in 2, 1 in 2.5, whatever, and leave it there for many months as we dry out and wet up. And we can intensively instrument the clay to see what's happening. And we can use that data to validate the model because the toe of the slope is what has got what we're calling an active toe. So the toe of the slope is against a board and the board can move down slope as the material starts to lose strength. So we're going to have a system which is supporting this end board and we're going to keep the load on it constant. So if the soil starts to move and tries to put more load on this end board, we're going to move the end board back so that the soil can progressively move down the slope. And by doing this, we can model it in our numerical models and we can get additional data on how the changes in moisture from raining on it and drying it links through to changes in deformations. And that's going to be really important. We can also, we're designing it so we can put soil nails in and we can look at, you know, the capacity for soil nails. And we can also build a drain in it and monitor the pore pressures around the drain because there's a real uncertainty about how drains work in clay because the permeabilities are so low in the clay. You know, what's the effect of that? And the reason why we can look at the capacity of the slope and the capacity of these systems is that when we finish the test at say 1 in 2, we can lift the table up. So it's a tilting table. We can lift it up to 45 degrees and hold it there to see whether the slope fails. So we can look at the capacity in the slope and quantify how much capacity we've got in there. So that's being built now and it will be operating from the autumn.
So we've got, for instance, your model that you've created using clay. But for anybody that's done a site investigation, they'll know the difficulties of sampling clay and actually ensuring that the clay isn't damaged. So if you take a sample out the ground, do a triaxial test, make sure it's representative of how the clay would behave in situ. How on earth do you get a huge model? You mentioned the size, 10 by 10, I think you said.
That's the building. Yeah, the slope is 5 by 3 by 1.5.
Okay. So how do you possibly sample that much clay and get it to behave in the same way that it would out on site?
Good question. The first point is the results of the tests we do in the slope simulator won't be relevant for cuttings because cuttings have a control by the in-situ properties and structures of the clay, which I guess is where your point's coming from. So they don't help with that. What they help with is the embankments. So it's 50 tons of soil will be used to fill it up. So we're not going to be doing tests every week. But we'll do a test where we put the soil in and it might be in there for a year or two. So it's a large amount. So it's lorry loads of material. One of the reasons for making the device so... Well, there are two reasons for making... No, it's like the Spanish Inquisition. There are three reasons for making it so big. The first is that we can use compaction plant to replicate densities and structures of the material we put in there, which are representative of an embankment in the real world. Okay. So we can put in layers of, you know, depending on the plant we use. So sheep's foot rollers, they're going to be smallish, but sheep's foot rollers, we can put in reasonable thickness layers. We'll condition the material beforehand or get it delivered to site with the appropriate conditions. So that's really important, so that the slope will have structures and permeability and strength similar. Obviously, we will take samples and do tests. Yeah, so that's in terms of the actual material. In terms of, so the second reason it's so big is the forces which cause your slope to fail are gravity. So unless you make it big, it doesn't have the gravitational forces. You know, if you think of resolving gravity down the slope, the self-weight is what's really important in giving you some of the loads to cause it fail. And then
that was one of my other points. So there must be a scale effect. The soil particles are going to remain the same size, but the size of these embankments are clearly significantly smaller than you would get in reality. So does this scale, is it going to be truly representative of what would go on in the real world?
Yeah, it won't generate failures the same as an embankment, because at the bottom of the table is a rigid base. But we know that the weather-driven mechanisms of failure, this ratcheted failure, control relatively shallow failures. So, you know, there are mechanisms which cause deep failures, but the weather generally causes shallow failures. So we are looking at, you know, the top 1.5 meters. That's what we'll be looking at in our system. And so, yes, if it fails, it will generate a planar translational type failure above the base of the test facility. And that's not what would happen in an embankment. But what we can do is we can model that. So we can model what we've measured, if you like. And it's the soil mechanics and the links between the weather and the pore pressure change and the strains which we want to validate the model being able to replicate those. And then when it's used for the embankments, it's used with the appropriate boundary conditions, yeah. So the third reason it's so big is for one of the reasons you said, that if you want to put stabilisation measures in there, yeah, geogrids could be put in there, soil nails, it has to be big enough to use actual materials rather than a scaled soil nail or a scaled grid. And so we will be able to use. So we will have low friction sides to the device. So it will be like a plane strain problem.
Okay.
So you've picked up the challenges, yeah, which are the base.
But yeah, sorry about that.
But no, that's the, you know, to build a full scale embankment and to control it is just, yeah. We've got the Bionics embankment tries to do that on a scale on site, but they can't control the weather and others, and they can't take it to failure like we can do. So there are compromises with everything that you do. You know, there are pros of the large-scale simulator and there are cons, and you have to sort of manage them.
Yeah, I like the idea of controlling the weather. Nice and sunny outside today. But you mentioned about the making it wet and changing the behaviour. So to go from an undrained clay to a drained clay. Once you've done that, is that the end of the use of that material, and you've got to bring some more material in?
Yeah, I think thinking of undrained behaviour, you want to forget it. The best way to think about it is just thinking about effective stresses. So it's thinking about when it's dried out, it's got high effective stresses because of the pore suctions. And when it's wet up, it's got small positive pore pressures. We can go up to obviously hydrostatic. And so that gives you, because suctions, when you dry clays out, you can get suctions of hundreds, if not thousands of kilopascals. And so the cycles of stress, of effective stress, and which affects the shear stress, you can place the slope through, and the slopes go through in the real world, is actually many hundreds of kPa, that cycle. And when you wet and dry it, what you do is you form a near-surface layer of clay which has different properties. So going back to Newbury, where they built it in the 1990s, and there's grass and shrubs on it, and it's a cutting. So it was in situ, unweathered, some of it's unweathered London clay, which had been buried for millions of years, and they obviously excavated it. Within 10 to 15 years, there is a weathered profile of a metre, metre and a half of soil, which has got completely different properties to what's beneath it. And that's really important that you understand that, and that is included in the models, because that upper layer is how the water gets in and out of the soil. And what we've shown through Achilles and other people, we've done measurements of permeability in that near surface, is that the permeability of the clay is orders of magnitude higher than a couple of metres down. And if you don't model that, you don't get the correct response between weather and how the clay behaves. And so that's one of the big lessons we've learned from Achilles and previous projects. So the Achilles team has worked on previous funded projects for 15 years. And so this is a long-term series of projects looking into this. So in our simulator, we will be able to start forming that cracked and modified upper layer, and we can monitor because we can put more instruments in, and we can have them more densely. We can understand those processes better, and so all these little bits in the end go together. If you want to look at the impacts of climate change, if your model's been validated and you start to put the scenarios for climate change in, you know, we've done some modelling which is indicating that the rate of deterioration will increase. So it is a concern, which is not a surprise, because the cycles of dry summers, wet winters will get bigger. So the stress is the soil. And so that's why the stakeholders are interested, because it might make things worse.
Yeah. So in terms of validating models, we've referenced a couple of different types of models here. And I think it'd be useful for the listeners to understand what we mean by the terms, because we'll have some people that are fairly new to all of this, maybe just starting on their university careers, for instance. And numerical models really are about, it's a computer programming. I've used Plaxis. I'm sure there's tons of other numerical model programs out there, but you define the properties of an element, and you connect lots and lots of nodes, and the movement of one affects the next. And you can make these nodes quite large, or you can make them very small. And obviously the smaller they are, the more complex the model, the bigger the computer you need, and the longer the computation takes. But you can get potentially a very sophisticated representation of what happens. But of course, with any numerical model, you put junk in, you get junk out. I don't know if I've summed that up well, Neil.
You summed it up very well. So we're using a model called FLAC. So basically, you represent a slope, a cutting embankment, by dividing it into elements, and you give those elements properties. And the importance of the modelling that we're doing, which lots of people do in other applications, is that it's a coupled model. And by a coupled model, what it means is that the fluid flow changes the pore pressures, which changes the stresses, which causes deformation. So the model allows you to couple simulating water coming in at the surface due to rain or being removed due to evapotranspiration. And that then is coupled with the stress changes, and that's why when I talk about validating the model, we need to validate the process from changes of moisture content due to water going in and out all the way through to strains in the soil. And so our models do that. And when I said that our models run with daily weather, every day water is put into the slope or taken out, and then the model is solved for equilibrium, which changes the stresses. And then the next day in the life of the model, in terms of modelling every day of the life of that asset, that slope, it's run again. And so to run 150 years in some of our models might take a week to actually run the numerical model. So they're very sophisticated models. Now, we're not suggesting that designers for national highways or network rail or environment agency will run these models. What we're trying to do is we're trying to get guidance out of these models to allow the design or assessment of slopes in the future. So one of the groups who are interested in that in our work is HS2. They're in the process of designing their slopes in the next phase, so to Crewe and up to Manchester. And the deterioration I've been talking about reduces the soil strength, the soil shear strength. You know, so we know we have a soil strength of a stiff clay. It goes from peak through critical state to residual. And so we need to give them potential failure surfaces and where they might be. We're getting that from our models. We need to give them what the worst case pore pressures might be, probably hydrostatic. But one of the things we're starting to look at for them and others is, if you want your infrastructure to last for 120 years, which HS2 do, we want to design our slopes, 120 year design life, we can start to design for a design life, because our model tells us how the strength is deteriorating over decades. And so we can start to advise on what strength they should use in their limited equilibrium analyses, which is pretty standard and everybody knows how to do them, which strength you should use if you want it to be standing up in 120 years. So it introduces the concept of designing for life based on understanding the deterioration processes and how the strength might reduce in your slope due to these cycles that I've been talking about.
Sure. Yeah, and talking cycles, another term that we've mentioned a few times is the centrifuge model. And this is something I hear a lot when universities are mentioned. I kind of have an idea like machines whizzing around trying to accelerate changes in conditions. Could you explain in terms of geology, centrifuge models, how it all works?
Yeah, I'm not an expert on centrifuge modelling. We don't have one at Loughborough. There's a few around the country, but they're expensive things to run. But basically, as you said, you have a block of soil in a special container on the end of an arm, and you spin it round, and that increases gravity. And so you can do scale model tests, but at full gravity. And so when talking about, you know, the reason why our slope simulator has to be so big, because we need gravitational forces, you can build a model which might be 500 by 500 millimetres and spin it around in a centrifuge, and you can put stresses into it as if it was a 10-metre high slope with a full gravitational stresses on it. And so the work we used to validate our numerical model was done at Cambridge by Andy Tate, because he was interested in clay soil. So he used kaolin soil, built a model, excavated it, and then he built an environmental chamber around his soil slope. So he was whizzing it round to increase the gravity, but he also sprayed it with water and allowed water to go in, and then he dried it out and allowed it to come out. So he was cycling his little slope model, but under representative gravities. And he got this ratcheting slope behaviour, which showed progressive failure. And so that was some of the early work. So it was done in, I don't know, 2003, 4, 5, somewhere around that work, and he's published that work. And we've worked with Andy Tate to use his data and to validate the model, and he's been involved in some of our papers on it. So we've used data from different areas to try and it might seem a bit odd that we spent so much effort and so many years trying to validate these numerical models. But your statement about rubbish in, rubbish out is the real concern. If they're not validated, then there is no point of feeding climate change data into them and looking at what happens over the next 100 years. So there's a lot of effort gone into that part of the project.
Yeah, but just on the detail of that centrifugal model, so if you're trying to increase the gravity, you can replicate a longer period of time that it would have been under that state. So many turns of this machine is the equivalent of a day. Is that right? Is there like a correlation factor?
There are factors on time and fluid flow as well. Yeah. I mean, the main one is that increase in the self-weight of the model to represent gravitational forces, but also time is, there are also factors of ways of modelling time, yeah.
That's really intriguing. And all this discussion, all these projects, which obviously are going to be great for people around the world if we can further our understanding and improve our environments, they're going to get people, young people, really excited about coming into geotechnics. We had one of the podcasts with Nick Kaur and a couple of other guests talking about geoscience and getting people involved in geoscience. Where do you see things? You're pretty close to the numbers there and looking at how many people are signing up for geoscience courses or civil engineering courses. What's the current thoughts on the trends and where do you see courses developing? We were involved in, of course, the engineering doctorate program at Loughborough University. There's degree apprenticeships that have come along. What are the thoughts within Loughborough University around the development of those various schemes?
It's a challenge because there is a lack of knowledge of 18-year-olds, who are the people who are choosing to go on courses, about engineering in general, civil engineering in particular, and geotechnics. They have no idea. I mean, there has been an impact, we think, of programmes on television like on the Crossrail project, etc. So there are examples out there. The problem is, I think, a lot of 18-year-olds struggle to understand the sort of mechanisms and interests and what sort of things you might need to study. So I think that the challenge for geotechnics, geotechnics has an advantage that it takes people from engineering geology backgrounds as well as civil engineering. So that's good. And geotechnical teams in industry are a lot stronger for having people from the two backgrounds working together. When it works well, that is, you know, understanding the processes forming soils and then understanding the analysis and physical behaviour of them in an engineering sense, you know, needs that match. But getting people into civil engineering is a challenge. You know, we need people who've got maths and another science. Everybody's fighting for those. Our student numbers are holding up, but we're certainly not inundated, because everybody wants to be civil engineer. That's certainly not the case. And when you talk to the students about why they want to be civil engineers, nearly all of them will say, I want to design big buildings, I want to design bridges. And then as the geotechnical group, along with my colleague Paul, who you know very well, our task is to try and persuade them that geotechnics is really interesting and that maybe that's something they want to do. And to be fair, when it gets to the end of a civil engineering course, students do want to do geotechnics or water engineering or water quality. And so they realise through the course that being a civil engineer is a lot broader than just doing bridges and high buildings, which of course is very exciting, but gets a lot of publicity. And yeah. So that on that side, you know, I think we turn out our fair number of students who go off and work in geotechnical sections. You know, we have that every year. And yeah. Part of that is through our projects that we run with them, so the final year dissertations. And one of the reasons why doing research at university is really important is that we all run projects based on our research interests. And that means the students can use equipment and look at problems which they would never look at as part of the general engineering. So, you know, geotechnics taught in a civil engineering course is all the basic stuff. But I've got students looking at wetting and drying of clays and progressive failure and all stuff like this. And we've had students, Alice has got students looking at acoustic emission monitoring. So we try and excite them that way by yeah. getting them involved in our project and using bits of kit. And to be fair, Alistair, I'm sure he won't mind me saying this, he was an undergraduate at Loughborough and he did his final year dissertation with me. And I said, I've got these new sensors we're going to do some monitoring at a site. And he enjoyed it so much. He did a PhD with me and he enjoyed that so much that he won his own fellowship. And now he's an academic in the next office and he's leading the next phase of acoustic emission research on buried infrastructure, picking up deformations of ground from buried infrastructure. So, you know, there's some great success stories.
Yeah, but it is a challenge. That's Alistair Smith for the listeners' benefit, who's been working with you on these projects. In fact, what you described was basically my journey into geotechnics. So I joined up at Loughborough on the civil engineering course. Yes, exactly that. Interested in bridges, tall buildings, and structures. And I thought, well, this is great. You know, there's some amazing stuff that I could potentially get involved with. And Paul Fleming that you mentioned was my personal tutor, and he set me up with a final year dissertation on piles in cohesionless soils. And I went in the lab and made these models and tested them and started to learn more about it. And well, you know, Paul so well, is such a infectious personality and got a amazing amount of passion still after all these years for geotechnics. And I think that's something that really conveyed itself to me and really set me on a path to my career in the industry. And thank you to you, Neil, and to all your geotechnical colleagues for encouraging individuals like Alistair and myself to go on and come into the industry. I do feel, in terms of bringing the sort of 17, 18-year-olds into university, like geotechnical engineers have almost got an advantage, because actually concrete, steel, those above-ground structures, actually it's a bit of a turn-off now, I think, for young people, whereas soils and the engineering of whether it be these slopes or embankments cut, it's seen, it literally is greener by virtue of the vegetation. So maybe we will see more people coming in and we'll get the best possible talent. I think in the past it almost felt like a poor relation, but perhaps things will start to change and with that we'll see the development of these really sophisticated bits of technology that you've so eloquently explained to our listeners today.
Yeah, it's a very good point. I think sustainability is a big hook, and a lot of our students like that. And geotechnics potentially is very sustainable, particularly if we can keep infrastructure running and rather than replacing and rebuilding. And there's a real success story over Network Rail in many respects. You know, that their infrastructure cuttings embankments were built by the Victorians and are still being used. There are hundreds of billions of pounds worth of asset that we run our trains on every day. And we can't replace them. One, because we can't afford it. And two, because we need to run the trains on them. You can't say we're going to remove this embankment and you can't go on a train for a year while we do the embankment. So actually keeping this infrastructure going and repairing the bits which are the closest to failure. I mean, Network Rail are trying to do this and spending a lot of money on it. Now, they've got thousands of kilometres of earthworks, and they know that hundreds of kilometres, if not a couple of thousand, are in a poor condition. And so projects like Achilles are trying to help them work out which are the bits they should spend their money on. And that's actually very sustainable if they do that, rather than having a blanket, well, we'll do it because it's, you know, a Wednesday and this slope is of this angle. You know, if we can help them understand where on the deterioration curve a slope is and relative, you know, we can't tell anybody when a slope's going to fall down, but we could maybe tell them whether this material with this geometry, height and slope angle, is more likely to be close to failure than this. And they can start to target where they do monitoring or where they put their resources. So there's a real place for engineers to have a big impact on sustainability, because moving bulk materials around, as you know, Steve, is very unsustainable. The transport costs of moving material to a site, soils, or moving them off a site, is one of the biggest CO2 costs of a construction project. And so being really smart about geotechnical solutions is something which should really turn our, you know, young engineers on. I mean, my final comment on this, I guess, would be that it's a bit disappointing that if we have PhD projects, we get very few applications from UK people. They either don't see the value of doing a PhD, or because of the length of time they've studied and they've got a loan, they just want to get working and paying it off. We could get hundreds of really brilliant Chinese and Indian students who are great, but they have higher fees. So keeping the research going in universities and keeping research training of people who can then go into industry and help do all these new things is quite a challenge.
How do we change that?
I really don't know. Pay them more.
Okay.
So, you know, the grants maybe just not high enough. One of the big changes occurred when MEng, civil engineering courses came in, because they added a year on. So you've got students who are doing 4 years of study. Most students at Loughborough do a year in industry, so they've done 5 years. And so it takes quite a special person to say, I spent 5 years, I'm going to spend another 3 years doing a PhD. And I think that had a bit of an impact. You know, we're training good engineers by that extra year as MEng students, but it has made a difference to universities.
Is that not the place of the engineering doctorate programme? So people can carry on working and do the research to get the best of both worlds, a bit like a degree apprenticeship.
It was, and it's now finished at Loughborough, and the funding wasn't renewed. The UK Research Council didn't fund in the last round where we all applied. We applied for another engineering doctorate to be able to have those projects with industry, so that we were working on industry's problems, and the student was partly in the university, part in industry. But they didn't fund them. They didn't fund anybody's. They funded straight PhDs. And they fund case awards where there is a link with industry and there's a top-up for the student, and we have some of those, but it's not as, the students aren't as embedded as they were in the engineering doctoral scheme, which, you know, we ran at Loughborough for many, many years.
Well, that seems a massive missed opportunity, and something that I will personally take up. Listeners won't be aware, I'm shortly going to become the chair of the Ground Forum, which is an umbrella body for a number of different ground-related disciplines. So the British Geotechnical Association, the British Drilling Association. Check out the website, you can find all of the details. But we have got great links to government. And if there's a way that we can get everybody to come together to join forces and lobby government to provide some extra funding to support the engineering doctorate programmes, then that can only be good for the country as a whole. So leave that one with me, Neil. I might have to lean on your resources there at Loughborough to help with tackling that challenge, but let's not give up on it.
Yeah, that'd be very welcome. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening. We have lots of fascinating episodes lined up, but if you have any suggestions for potential guests and topics, please get in touch with me, Steve Hadley, via LinkedIn.